This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations.
Hello, everybody. This is Chasing Encounters, and this is Yesid Ortega. Today, we have another person, very important person in our Latinx family. Her name is Nae, but I'm not going to go into details about where she's coming from because she's going to get the chance to let us know a little bit about where she's coming from. She has a connection with Japan, for what I understand, and she's going to let us know all of these things about her background, both personally and family about. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you, Yesid. Thank you very much for having me today.
No problem. Thank you for accepting the invitation. It's so important for me to have somebody like you in our podcast. So, yeah, well, I understand that your last name is Hanashiro, right?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about yourself and why is this background with Japan?
So my dad, he's Peruvian, but he was the first child who was born in Peru. Both my grandparents from my dad's side, they are from Japan. They are from Okinawa. And they migrated to Peru right after the Second World War. My grandfather already had some family living there.
Right.
So I am Peruvian, and my dad is also Peruvian, but we have like this, I think that it's has become more clear to me, well, now that I'm living here, how much that influence, how much the Japanese heritage has influenced my identity, even though I feel 100% Peruvian and I've lived there for most part of my life. But it's interesting, once you live abroad, that you start noticing how there are like other cultural parts of the identity that have been enabled by growing up in a half Japanese family.
And what are those things that you noticed?
So there, sometimes it's part of like the family structure, the importance of certain roles. Also, it might be sometimes in the way that we cook, or like the way that we express some kind of things. It's still a process in which I'm trying to like, that I've been reflecting a lot, because sometimes it are things that I don't know if they're like part of myself as an individual. And sometimes it's like, well, this is also how I've been integrating these practices that come from a Japanese family. But at the same time, I've been raised by a Peruvian mother, and my dad, he has lived all his life in Peru, so it's not that the Japanese heritage can be so visible sometimes.
Right. No, very interested. And just so our listeners understand, Nae, she's Peruvian and Japanese, so she has these both nationalities or those cultures within her, which is so interesting. And she also, just so everybody knows, she's also a PhD student here at the University of Toronto as well. So we have a background that is very interesting, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to her. Nae, I wonder if you speak any Japanese.
No, and that's also something that has been really, I think that I didn't question that part too much when I was in Peru, but I've realized that also part of like the history of the Japanese community has something to do with that. So what happened was that in Peru after during the Second World War, Peru aligned with the States, so they start making the lives of Japanese immigrants not so easy over there. So in the case of my family, but it happened to other families as well, for them, they didn't want to be discriminated. Since they were already different by because of the way they looked and the way that they and the language they spoke. My grandparents didn't teach my dad nor their brothers and sister to speak in Japanese because they didn't want that to be an issue. They wanted them also to learn Spanish perfectly. They didn't want them to be struggling with language and like to be part of the Caribbean culture. So my dad, he doesn't speak Japanese either. He knows some words, of course, and I also know some words or some expressions, but I've never learned to speak the language.
Wow, it's so interesting. I mean, I'm not surprised that this is happening and this has happened to you, because this in North America, this happens to all the immigrants all the time. They arrived and because they want to adapt and assimilate to the context, then they little by little start losing both their languages and their heritage, you know, adapting more to the context in which they have arrived. So I'm not surprised that your grandparents did not teach the Japanese language to your parents or great-grandparents and etc. because of this fear of being discriminated, this fear of being different from the other. Now that you are a grown-up woman, do you have any interest in learning Japanese at some point or not necessarily?
Yes, and in fact, there have been many moments in the past in which I've tried, but I never have, and I never make myself enough time to learn it.
Right.
But yeah, I started when I was 16, I started having like informal lessons to have a notion of grammar. And then this year, I also tried to start again.
Right.
But well, like doing a PhD, it's kind of demanding sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's something that I definitely want to do, and every time that I can, I try to at least grasp a notion of how the language works, because it's so, something that it's also really interesting and that is really different from Spanish and from English, of course.
Definitely. No, another thing that I wanted to mention is that our listeners understand that this podcast is about languages, cultures, and diversity and identities, of course. And now that you have lived in North America, especially here in Toronto, which we are very diverse, I wonder if at some point in your experience, have you experienced any issue related with your background or the way you appear, people confusing you from places where you don't necessarily relate to?
I am never sure how people see me, because for example, like some people, when I say that I am from Peru, but that I have a family from Japan, they say like, oh yeah, like I could tell.
Now I can see your face.
Like I was wondering while I was looking at you, but at the same time, sometimes people just don't realize. So for me, it's always has been like this open question.
Right.
Well, I think that because, well, I'm in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, and I teach Spanish for beginners. I also teach literature classes, but my first experience teaching here was language. Mm. And something that I realized that for me was really new was this notion of Spanish as language and as a language that is from Spain, originally from Spain.
Well, it is originally.
It is definitely originally from Spain, but I think that the notion that because that's the origin, that is like the purest Spanish, mm-hmm. or that's mm-hmm. the one that you value the most and that you the one that you want to learn, was something a bit striking, and also. Also, sometimes the generalization that some people think that some people might have said to me, "Oh, because you're Spanish," and I'm like, "No, I speak Spanish, but I am from Peru, and right. It's a different country."
No, I see. I understand exactly what you're talking about, because I think it was two or three episodes before this one we talk about the idea of policing the language and the idea that in North America, in the United States and Canada, when you speak Spanish is this idea that you have to speak Spanish in a certain way that mimics the land that brought Spanish, which is Spain. And if you are not, if you don't speak Spanish in that way, then you are sort of perceived as a lower class. So I understand that when people may equate Spanish equal Spain, it's coming from a place where, in my opinion, of ignorance, because you don't know that there are other countries in the planet that the there is in which Spanish is spoken, right? And also the beauty of diversity of languages, especially the Spanish that you as a Peruvian person speak is different from me from a Colombian background and Mexico and you name it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's important for our audience to understand that there are different variations of the Spanish language. There is not only one, and even within the same Spanish from, let's say, in Peru, within Peru, there are different variations of the same Spanish, and so on and so forth. So, So anyways, now that you brought up the idea of you teaching Spanish, now that you are here in Canada, do you have any anecdotes or anything that you remember teaching Spanish that comes to your mind? Something that you remember, oh my God, yeah, one day I was teaching Spanish and imagine this thing.
Not one that I could think right now. I think that what struck me the most at the beginning, that I had no idea how they perceive Spanish as language and also like Latin America as a region. Like, so for example, like my first class, I asked them which were the words that they knew in Spanish. And of course, the word was despacito.
Uh-huh.
So I think that something that I've come to realize a lot is how reggaeton has been one approach to the Spanish as a language for a lot of my students. And that can become a common ground for most of, even if they don't like reggaeton.
Right.
It's something that becomes like this cultural reference. Or something that they have been in touch somehow.
Right, definitely. No, I must agree with you. Like, a lot of people equate Spanish, and the first thing that they comes to their mind is this song, Despacito, that sometimes they don't even know what this means. It's just like the song is so catchy that they keep singing it and humming it, and they don't know the real meaning. So I invite our audience to go ahead and Google Despacito and dance it and read it and sing it along with other folks. Okay, so moving on a little bit with another piece of information here about you. I also understand that you have experience in the arts community, specifically theater. So I want to know a little bit more background on that, like you with this relation with arts and theater. How is that you decided to enter into this field?
So I think that art has always been part of my life. I started studying music when I was really, really small, like a kid, really, really young. And then I did my major in literature, in Hispanic mm-hmm. literature. Mm-hmm. But right after, out of the blue, I was offered a position as TA for a class in drama. Still, it was from a literary perspective. Mm-hmm. We were not doing analysis of the performances, but more like the literary text. But I taught that class for quite a few years. And then that's the moment in which I fell in love of theater. So when I did my master's, in cultural studies, I decided to do my thesis on an Argentine playwright. And his theater plays are quite amazing. So that's also the moment in which, like, I started this relationship with theater because I was teaching the class. Then I started like being this really passionate spectator of different theater plays, and it also became part of my scholar history by doing my thesis about these theater plays. So that's one part, I think. And then when I came here to study the PhD, I knew that I wanted to focus on Peruvian theater. But it also brought me like this completely wide dimension of performance studies, which is more popular in the North American academia. Like in I think that it's also really interesting in terms of language, because in Peru, when you talk about performance, you definitely talk about like performance as public performance, performance art. But here, because you have like this notion of performance studies, they can be, they have this really big umbrella in which you can focus on specific things such as theater and drama, but you can also be taking into consideration other expressions that are more like hybrid, that they are not really fitting into that label.
Can you give us some examples of those hybrid expressions? Because I look at your face and it seems like this is something that exciting for you.
Yeah, like it is really exciting. So first of all, like one thing is that Diana Taylor, what she says is that performance can be an object of study. So you can study something that is performance art, like a theater play, like a performance, like also a music performance. But she also says that it can also be something that you can also approach to something as performance. So in this case, you can analyze different practices in society, but looking at them from that perspective, in which you think of someone as a performer that is, I'm sorry for being redundant, but this performer is performing something in front of an audience and then considering how the thing is staged. And from that perspective, you could, for example, analyze a political discourse. Like you could study like a politician who is staging something, like how he's presenting himself, how he's performing in the moment in which he's giving his speech, how he or she is interacting to the audience that is listening to him or her. So from that consideration, you can approach to many, many different things, not only things that are happening in like a closed space like the one or a theater.
Do you think we are performing the role of academics, scholars? Are we actors and the world, the university is the stage?
Definitely. I think that in really concrete examples, we do it once we enter into a classroom. We are performing a role and we have an audience. And the way that we assume that identity is also related to how the system and society thinks and values these roles. So for example, like what is interesting about the notion of performance studies is also that they try to make visible how these practices are performed, because they are not natural. We learned them and we enact them and reenact them on a daily basis. So for example, the kind of teacher that I become in my classroom, it's also kind of like this performance of how society is expecting me to be a teacher, how I navigate these different expectations, also how I navigate the expectations of my students, what I think that these are their expectations. Also, it's the notion of performance means that there's like knowledge that is being conveyed somehow. So it's also that the way that I learn, like the way that I'm performing this identity, means that I am reenacting how I learned that I should be this person.
I'm glad that you're talking about this issue, because I got a curious question. You mentioned this idea of society expecting me to be this persona, right? And there are certain expectations of the performer, the performance consumers. So let's say the people out there are consumers of our ways we perform. Do you think, or what are your thoughts on, are we being true to ourselves, to our own real identity when we go out and perform for others because we want to please those expectations.
Well, something that is interesting also about performance is that it can become an action in which you can either, one, reproduce what others are expecting of you, but at the same time you can be resisting or opposing to that. So it is important to know that you have these two ways. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can even do it at the same time. Sometimes you might not be aware that you're reproducing some practices or some discourses, and at the same time you might be contesting others. Or sometimes in the moment in which you think that you are contesting to some kind of power dynamics, you are reproducing power in other ways. So that's also something important about the notion of performance, that you have this double, this twofold. Yes. Action.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I am usually very interested in these topics of power and resistance and all of those sorts of things. And I think we as humans or as individuals, we have agency to, as you said, to contest and to resist the status quo. And as I see myself, I'm not going to speak for others, but as an actor who goes out in the streets and the world and performs depending on where we are, right? And then you mentioned the idea of, and I have the choice, either I reproduce this performance so it perpetuates, or I resist how I perform. And I think, like you mentioned, the idea of navigating, we become these people, these pilots, we go into the world and navigate, and depending on the situation, then, okay, I'm going to resist in this moment, or I am reproducing this. I think one of the key things here is about being aware of who we are. Or in reality, I'm a person who's performing for resisting, or I'm a person who's reproducing, or I am both. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that I totally agree. And at the same time, I would add that this is something that can also be strategic. Sometimes you are performing, because identities are intersections, yeah, by gender, race, class, age, many things. Mm-hmm. Then in some context, you might be strategically performing one part of your identity. Of course, there's not just one part, but you might be appealing to one of the many things that are part of your identity. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. No, I really like this topic a lot, but we need to move on into the next topic, which is related, obviously. So you are an expert, I would say an expert, in arts and performance, and then you've been interested in the arts, and you've been interested in music, etc., etc., and then you finish your PhD, in which you talk about performing, this idea of performing in, discussing or investigating about the Argentine playwright, right? So now you're moving into the PhD, and how do you connect this experience with the arts and the performance with your current work in the PhD?
So my dissertation project was about Peruvian theater, and it has shifted in the past month.
Why? Well, let's see this. Tell us first what you thought.
Okay.
Explain a little bit. This is what I was going to do, and then you tell us, why did you change it and what is it now?
How okay. about that? Perfect. Yes, so I was focusing on how theater had become a platform to question national identity. I wanted to focus from feminist perspective in how also these questions had to do with, for example, like how national identity in some place was really talking from a middle class whitish man point of view, and how if, for example, like some of the main characters of this place were sort of like working as a metaphor of the country. Mm-hmm. and the way that they were represented was as someone who could, that had the chance to grow up, but they couldn't, and they didn't manage to really have like a project. That was kind of like a representation of Peru as a country.
Right.
So I wanted to take a look at those kind of representations, and also see how they were shifting in the latest years. And then I realized that even though I find that this is a really important discussion, I also like to think from a, again, like a broader perspective. And I was all the time trying to make connections that were to other contexts. So suddenly, like, to talk just about Peru was feeling like not enough. I was all the time, while I was studying Peruvian theater, I could see connections to how Argentine theater had influenced Peru. And also, like, when I was looking from as a theater as a social practice, how social practices from other spaces were also part of the dialogue. So that's the moment in which it became like more evident that I need to make some kind of shift. And then my supervisor also kind of like, she talked to me and asked me, well, perhaps you could make this like a broader discussion considering not only theater but performance from this perspective that we were talking about a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that I wanted to include other countries in the discussion. And a shifting point was like the performance of Las Tesis, mm-hmm. like the A Rapist on Your Path, which became more evident how art can play a role in the political sphere as well. And if I was doing this analysis from a feminist point of view, it made sense to have this notion of how gender identities were being contested from performances, and this kind of activism is not working just within the limits of national frontiers, mm-hmm. but because these movements are transnational.
So you're studying different nationalities, like different countries?
Yeah, so now the plan is something that I haven't worked too, like I still have to figure out some things, but the main idea now is to try to see these performances that have been moving from different countries. So for example, like Un Violar en Tu Camino, A Rapist on Your Path, uh-huh. this performance, they started in Chile. I want to analyze how it worked there, but also how it moved to, for example, Argentina and Peru. And there's, for example, another performance really interesting in Peru. And even though it works a lot, like it is talking about a specific thing of the Peruvian history, it has been presented in different countries, mm-hmm. and I think that to consider how it has been circulating in these other countries might also give us a sense of the importance that might have that it has to talk about this issue in Peru.
You mentioned something very interesting, which I want to highlight at this part of the podcast, is this street performance that was born in Chile in protest of things that have been happening against, you know, women and sexual violence, etc. And the name of this street performance is called A Rapist in Your Path. So correct me if I'm wrong. So you are sort of, in a sense, mapping out how this is just one example, but I'm assuming there are more, how this specific performance has moved around in different countries and how this performance is different or similar or reflects similar sentiments in each one of the countries, something like that?
So what I think that I'll do, because I think that it can be a really ambitious project, is to start looking at the performance in its own context.
Okay.
And what kind of demands they were making. That also, like, what, how you create this performance, it's also really interesting in terms of how it's contesting power,
right.
Neoliberalism and patriarchy, but also like how they work together. Mm-hmm. But considering that, it's also interesting to see how it was replicated in, for example, Argentina and also in Peru, and how they change some things of the performance. They appropriate part of the performances that still, they were still talking about a common topic, but at the same time, there were specificities from their own local experiences that were that were staged.
Right. Do you think you talked about the idea of appropriating?
Mm-hmm.
In this specific case, when there is this performance that was born in Chile, right? The rape is in your path. And then it was appropriated in other countries, Colombia, Argentina, Mexico, and also came all the way to North America. So it has been replicated. But the notion of appropriating here, do you think it's a good thing or it's a bad thing?
I think that the notion of appropriation can be a bad thing. However, in the case of like the collective that created these performances, they use that word. First of all, they do it to appropriate the anthem of the police forces to contest power.
Nice.
And in second place, they also have they have said in different interviews how people and feminist groups started to make this performance their own performances.
Right.
So there's this notion in which like you're taking this, but you are translating the performance to your own context, not only translating in terms of like making a connection to your context, but also in terms of language, because the performance has been enacted in I think that about 50 countries.
So
there's also the language translation. So appropriation, it can be definitely a bad thing, but it also, but we also do it as a way to resist power.
Right. No, this is very interesting. I actually like your proposed study, right? Because it looks at those ideas of resisting power and what performance specifically is doing to resist or contest power. And this is a good excuse to conduct research, right? Have you thought about what you were asked about the methodology that you will be using? What are you going to be interviewing people? Are you going to be observing and taking notes or taking videos, photographs? How is it going to work?
So most of the performances that I'm studying, they are already recorded. So I am analyzing that and I'm doing a really close reading of how these performances are staged. Something that is important for me coming from literature is, for example, sometimes lyrics, the written word. But at the same time, something that this is my background studying theater is how in theater, word can have, it is important. But the thing is that you have to consider that it is not isolated from a broader context in which we're also talking about like, the way that word is being used, how the stage is created, like scenic elements that you have to consider. There are like a lot of signs over there, like how people is dressed, how the performers talk, what other elements sometimes are visual objects are part of that. So that's part of my analysis. I would also like to conduct some interviews to have. So far, because I've shifted a bit my project, I'm using interviews that are already in set media or like scholarly articles. But I will also like to conduct some interviews to performers because they give you also the context in not only in which it was created, but the moment in which it was staged, which
yes.
is also really interesting
yeah.
to consider.
Yeah, they give you the insights of how they felt in that moment
mm-hmm.
when they perform the specifics, right? Because what happened in Colombia or Chile or in Argentina or in North American cities is different every moment. So, but if you interview this specific person, you get the insights
mm-hmm.
of what's happening. And I really like the work that you're doing, and I hope you the best with this research because I think it's very innovative. It's something that I have not seen before, and it's something of the interest of our listeners who are seeking to understand how performance art behaves and how can it be of how it can be used to support or not the most marginalized communities, in this case, what's happening to women in Latin America. So I am glad for that. So speaking of that idea of performance, moving on to our next and last question related to performance, to the idea of a stage, the idea of being innovative as well. A while ago, have a similar conversation about what to do and what not to do when you are isolated at home, you know, and how people have been very creative online, speaking about performing online and why not. So I want Naya to share us a little bit about something very innovative that is happening on the internet right now as we speak. People have been creative and getting together in communities via Zoom through different activities and why not, to help us connected and to help us be with the people that we care, especially now that we're in COVID times, in the pandemic. So I remember when Naya told me about this interesting thing that's happening online that is called the PowerPoint party, right? And this is only happening in Peru, or it's happening elsewhere now?
So what I know from the PowerPoint party group is that this is not their idea, in terms of like it happened, like I'm not sure where, but the idea of having these parties in which you share PowerPoint presentations, it's something that already kind of like happened. But in the case of this group in particular, we are a team of 10 people, all from Peru, and I'm the only one who is living abroad. We started playing. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that we started playing among us and sharing PowerPoint presentations about different topics, relevant, irrelevant, things that sometimes you have this knowledge that it is important for you, but you don't find it useful, for example, in your academic life or in your work life, but it's something that still you feel really passionate about. So there was a space in which we could share those ideas.
Right.
And the other thing that is really important is that it was born out of just playing. So the idea was that we were playing, like, just like you have like board games night. This was like we had our PowerPoint party nights, and then we realized at some point that these presentations that we were doing were not only fun, but they were also like helping us to navigate this moment. But it also they involved a lot of work, and we suddenly realized, well, people might be interested to look at this experience. So we had one in which we invited just friends who wanted to like see our presentations and participate, not presenting, but just like listening to us. And people were like really excited, and they said like, well, this is really, really fun. So that's when four of these people, Flavia, Daniel, Jorge, and Barbara, they said, well, perhaps we could start doing this as an entertainment for other people, not just let that go outside our group of these 10 people. So it became like this online event, and you could like pay to see the PowerPoint presentation. So it's now more like a work. Not what it actually implies, a lot of work, because we have to like organize these events, and it's really interesting because members of this team they come from totally different backgrounds. There's people from performing arts, from circus, but also from graphic design, from law. There are like three lawyers.
Wow.
So. Because we all have different backgrounds, we have different things that can enrich the process, and that's the moment in which this committee of four people, they started like making this as how this can be a party. It's yes, of course, we people share information, we laugh at this presentation, we also get surprised about the information that we didn't know, but also how can this be something in which people get involved. So for example, you can, it's not just that there are like these viewers who watch presentations, but they are, there's a lot of interaction in the chat. They look at the presentations and they're like writing and saying like what they think about, or if they have questions. So that's also kind of like this notion that we are I think that it gives us a sense that we can create some bonds in a moment in which we feel really isolated.
No, yeah, thank you so much for what you have said, because one of the reasons why I'm asking you this question is because I want the audience, the listeners, to understand that we, the academics, we, the researchers, not only have this serious life in which going to the laboratories and we do research and we write academic papers, but we also connect that personal life with our academic life and vice versa. So for you being in the world of the performing arts, the arts, the music, etc., so you were able to connect also on a personal level to create this group, online group, or PowerPoint parties in which you connect all of that experience, all of that background with the arts to play a role and to perform a role as an entertainer or supporting others to entertain, in which the way I see is how you look beyond your own community and outside those boundaries, right? And help and support the community to cope with what's happening right now with COVID, with the pandemic, and what a better way to use your experience as a performer, or your interest in music as well. And that's something that I appreciate, because that help people out there that to focus not only in the academic part, but also to find solace on other things that are not necessarily related to this quote-unquote serious work. And I like it, because I was part of one of these PowerPoint parties, and just so the audience knows, I went into this PowerPoint party without knowing what's going to happen. I was invited for a Halloween party, and yes, there are three people who are invited to do a PowerPoint presentation about a random topic that you don't know what this is about, and there is a lot of entertainment, and I personally felt that I wasn't at a party. Like I didn't, I was here in the apartment alone, but then I felt like I belonged to this group of people, and they were far apart. And then because this was a party, like a Halloween party, obviously I put on my dress as a Mexican wrestler, and then I did my part on performing as well, and it was fun. So I think these are ways in which we as sort of researchers, we can find other outlets to be and to be in relation with our communities. And I want to thank Nai for the work that she has done, both in the research that she's hoping to do, but also helping us connect communities with both performance art and entertainment. Do you have any last words for our audience, anything that you want to share with them, both about your research, the project that you're looking into, or you want the audience to know anything more about you?
Well, yeah, I think that I would just add that I think that the PowerPoint party kind of like they found me more than and it has become a really important space to have a balance between what you were saying, to have a balance between academic life and other space in which one can have it can be serious and at the same time in a really fun way. And I think that the space in which we let ourselves play is a really creative experience that can enrich our own academic work. So it's not that I definitely bring my academic background because it's part of me, but I think that right now I feel more that the space of entertainment or of fun with the PowerPoint parties is enriching my creative, this sense that of creation that can enrich my academic work more than vice versa.
Yeah, no, definitely. I totally agree with you with everything that you have said, and I really appreciate that you have come here today to share with us. as we are wrapping up, don't forget to play. This is not only about, you know, being a serious researcher and an uptight academic, but there are other things that we can do on our free time to enjoy, because it's no play, no gain. Thank you, Naya, for coming.
Okay, thank you, Yazid.
And you guys have a wonderful rest of the weekend. Bye.